Hi there, I'm Dan Jones, and this is my podcast. I'm an oceanographer working at the British Antarctic Survey in Cambridge, UK, and on this podcast I have casual, long-format conversations with people whose work intersects with climate in some way. For this episode, I was really happy to have Professor Ed Hawkins on the podcast. He's a professor of climate science over at the University of Reading in the Department of Meteorology. He's also really active online, both in terms of his Twitter account at Ed Hawkins. He's very often publishing, you know, relevant climate information there and really interesting climate graphics and visuals and animations. So he maintains a nice account. It's a good one to follow. Ed's been involved with a lot of different science projects, and we talk about some of those in this episode. So let's get into it quickly. I don't want to spend too much time here at the front babbling on and on. I guess without any other, there's no announcements I need to make. There's nothing that I need to mention. We're still rolling along. Looks like we're, in terms of the podcast, we've been able to maintain a, you know, roughly 2-week schedule, which is fine. So I'll do what I can to keep that on. So you should expect for the near future anyway, about every 2 weeks, you know, unless I mention otherwise, and I'll try to let you know if that does change into the future. So like I said, at @Ed_Hawkins on Twitter, and you can look him up on his Department of Meteorology webpage at the University of Reading. And let's just go ahead and jump right in. Thanks for joining us. Welcome to it. If this is the first one that you've downloaded and are listening to, here we go, Ed Hawkins.
But
surrounded by atmospheric scientists.
Yeah, which was kind of nice. Mm-hmm. I don't know, I kind of liked it. I kind of liked that atmosphere because I felt like I was getting, you know, by osmosis, mm-hmm. a lot of the you know, atmospheric concepts and stuff. That wasn't my research area, right? So I didn't, that's not like something I feel like I know the language. I feel like I know mm-hmm. the vocabulary.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But I don't necessarily, I don't have papers and stuff. I couldn't necessarily, you know, contribute to that. Yeah, cool. Let's see. Okay. Thanks for doing this.
Like, can you just remind me what this is all about? So you run a podcast.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So basically the kind of history of it is, you know, a few years ago, for a few years, I had this notion to, let me back up and say it this mm-hmm. way. So, I don't know, back in 2010 or 2011, I just started listening to a lot of these really long format podcasts, you know, while I'm washing dishes or, I don't know, walking or just doing something, you know, kind of mindless. Mm-hmm. And I just started enjoying them and just started, you know, absorbing them. And it's not a hyperbole to say I've listened to like hundreds of hours of them.
Wow. Okay.
So now my mind is warped, and I think this is how humans are supposed to, you know, interact and talk with each other. So now if I have a conversation, I've got to, like, you know, record it. And, because mm-hmm. there's just, that feels natural to me now. So I've had the idea for a while to apply that same kind of format to our field, mm-hmm. because you can have so many nice conversations and interesting conversations with people doing climate science. And even though I put it off for a while, my, you know, family encouraged me, and my colleagues, whenever I brought it up to them, they kind of gave me some further encouragement and said, yeah, that sounds good. Why don't you give it a try? Mm-hmm. So I started it back in January, just starting locally at Bass there with Dave Monday,
yes.
was here at Reading for a long time. Yeah. And I've done a few since then, and it's been really good. I've been surprised by, I've gotten, you know, some positive feedback from listeners, and people seem to enjoy this kind of really long format, casual style of conversation. Yeah. So that's been, been nice. Yeah. So really I've got some, you know, little notes and things, and that's just to kind of guide my, like, if there's a moment where I want to see, like, oh, well, let's go in this direction or that direction, that's fine. But I don't have I'm not trying to get specific answers mm-hmm. out of you. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to do the soundbite thing, right? I'm not trying to, like, pull anything. Because that's, I don't know. That's not good. That's not, like, a real conversation. Mm-hmm. So,
you chop bits out, you know, if needed? And
Not usually. Okay. I mean, if something comes up and you're like, I don't know, maybe you don't put that in there. That's fine. I don't mind taking that out.
Yeah.
But I leave most of the stuff in there because then it's just like an actual chat. Yeah, actual conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So and there's no minimum or maximum time. You know, mm-hmm. they can go as short as we want or as long as we want. I know we have some constraint because there's lunch.
Yeah, what time does Smurf start?
Smurfs, I think the lunch starts at 12, right?
12, okay.
And then the actual thing itself, the meeting itself starts at 1.
So we've got loads of time then.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, we're good.
Fine. Oh, sorry, I didn't need to worry about that.
Then. Yeah, so thanks for doing this.
That's all right.
Yeah,
no problem.
I'm really glad to be here and I'm glad to have you on because this is a really good opportunity. I looked at some of your tweets yesterday. I was really enjoying some of them because one of them, you're pretty active on Twitter, right? You know, you've got a nice presence there and you don't mind kind of putting yourself out there. And, you know, the one that caught my eye is where you said, you know, I mean, in order for, there's this conspiracy theory, right, that climate scientists are somehow faking it or somehow fudging the data. And this conspiracy theory is really popular in some circles.
Mm-hmm, it is.
And, but what I love about, you know, you pointed out how hard that would be, like how impossibly just crazy hard that would be for, you know, thousands of scientists over a couple centuries now to like consistently fake a bunch of measurements and a bunch of data and to like consistently, because, you know, all these data sets, like, you know, the physical system has these constraints built into it, you know, like conservation of energy and there's geostrophic considerations and all of these things. And, you know, we have a hard, I guess one of the ways I thought about it is like, we have a hard enough time dealing with the normal data.
Mm-hmm.
Like, can you imagine having like, here's the real data, and then somewhere else there's like a hidden server behind a firewall. Well, here's the fake data we're using to fool everyone. But I don't know. I like that you're pushing back against that. I like that you're kind of putting it out there. And it
it's also, I think, reminding people that, you know, although we have all these temperature measurements going back a couple of centuries, and that's our, you know, our best data set for understanding what's changed, it isn't the only data set we have. We have, you know, the records of the melting glaciers going back centuries.
Yeah.
We have satellite photographs of the Arctic melting. We have, you know, records of butterflies and ice melting in certain locations, you know, again, going back a very long time. And so the natural world is telling us that the world is warming, even if we didn't have any temperature measurements.
Yeah.
Even if you threw the temperature measurements away completely, we would still know that the planet was warming.
Yeah.
We're seeing sea levels rise due to the expanding water. And the melting ice. And so all of these indicators are telling us that something is changing.
Yeah, absolutely. It's all consistent.
Yes.
I think, it's all kind of pointing in the same direction. You know, the ocean heat content's going up and the surface temperatures are going up over long timescales, you know, over many decades kind of timescales. That was one of the things, you know, we're going to do the Smurfs meeting today. And so you're one of the lead, like, investigators on
Smurfs? I'm one of the lead scientists, yes.
Yeah, and I thought that might be fun to talk about, right? Because the whole, one of the ideas behind Smurfs as a project is looking at that land surface temperature record and trying to understand it, right? Because you've got these periods where the temperature doesn't, in the land surface temperatures, which is just like the very upper part of the ocean and the, you know, the land itself, you've got these periods where that temperature doesn't change much. It goes up, it might even go down a little bit. But it's kind of distracting, right? Because that time series, that's not necessarily a great measure of how much energy is going into the climate system, right? It's you can look at something more like ocean heat content, and that's been steadily, really climbing pretty steadily. That's like a nice steady thermometer. And that's a way more, because of like the ocean has this high heat capacity, right? That's a way better thermometer to use to try to understand and to see that, the Earth system is picking up a lot of extra energy and storing it in places. So Smurfs is trying to figure out something about how different parts of the climate system exchange energy with each other, which can lead to these surges and hiatuses in the surface temperature where it goes up or it doesn't go up for some period. So what's your kind of role in that? What have you been up to with the Smurf stuff? You know.
Yeah. So I mean, ideally, we would have measurements over the entire ocean going back centuries, but you know, we just don't. So we have to rely on the records we do have, and we have more records obviously at the surface.
Yeah.
and so that surface record is very important to understand all of those ups and downs that you mentioned. You know, we see, you know, in the 1920s, quite a, you know, a reasonable sized increase in global temperatures, as far as we can tell from our measurements. And then after the 1940s, we see a slight decline in temperatures. And after the 1970s, we see quite a rapid rise in temperatures. And then potentially there was this slight flattening in the more recent period, which has now disappeared with some very large El Nino events. And so understanding all the different reasons for those different ups and downs is important for us to understand what is the component due to increasing greenhouse gases and human activity. So we need to try and pick apart the signal, which is the human caused part, and the part which is just natural variations due to, say, small changes in the sun or volcanic eruptions, and all these other factors that we have to try and pick apart. And so understanding these ups and downs is very important, and Smurfs is doing a lot of work to try and understand those ups and downs a lot better.
Yeah, I was a little distracted over here because I've never actually seen a printed out IPCC Working Group 1 book, like the whole thing actually printed out.
It's pretty heavy.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I feel it?
Yeah. It's
what is this like?
It's 1,000 pages.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
It's like 5 inches thick or something.
Yeah.
Glossy pages too. Glossy
yes.
paper. Yeah. That's the. And it's got
200 and something authors.
Yeah.
600 odd contributing authors. It's probably one of the most time-intensive books ever written.
Yeah.
If not the most time-intensive book ever written.
And I was looking at all these like references. I mean, it must be referencing thousands and thousands of papers.
I can't remember the exact number, but it's tens of thousands, I think.
Tens of thousands
yeah.
of papers. That's crazy. I think about all the, I mean, you know, we know the time and effort that it takes to like make a single paper. And so that's the integrated effect, that book, you know, the IPCC Working Group 1 book, it represents the cumulative effort, you know, if it's 10,000 papers, then it's, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of hours working on this thing.
Yeah.
So it represents like the word synthesis is in the name, and that's what it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be, you know, so you're involved with the writing process for the next one, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes. I'm going to be a lead author on chapter one of AR6.
Nice. Have you started that yet?
Or we haven't. We start in June.
Start in June. Yeah.
With the first lead author meeting. And it's a process which is going to run for a few years with, you know, again, 200 odd authors from all over the world synthesizing the knowledge that we have about what's happening to our climate.
Yeah. I was talking with Mike Meredith about, he's leading this special report, and now, he was talking about how iterative it is and how hard it can be to, like, you know, get even a moderately sized group of people to kind of agree with each other and agree on a certain set of statements and things. So, I imagine, but you probably have been doing stuff like that and stuff like synthesizing before. I forget, were you involved with that one?
I was a contributing author last time round, and yes, it was, you know, there were elements where different scientists disagreed about specific, you know, points, and that's, you know, a normal part of the scientific process that we all go through to get a better understanding. You know, there's obviously things that we can all agree on and things we can all disagree on. And in the middle, there's you know, areas where, you know, there are sort of pockets of agreement about, you know, specific details that we want to better understand. And so synthesizing that consensus or the divergence of opinions is an important part of that process.
Yeah. So it's probably helps that you already know a decent number of people. I mean, obviously, you're working not just with people you already know, but I think sometimes about the whole community aspect of science, and you know how important that is, and those relationships are really important, and you know, maintaining those. And
I think we sometimes forget how large the community is. And there's lots of people, you know, on the list of authors that I know, and there's actually lots I don't know.
Yeah.
And that'll be fantastic to meet them and learn about their experiences.
I think Twitter has taught me that as well, because, I can just go through the list of who to follow. You know, there's the recommendations of who to follow. And I'm always surprised. I'm like, another physical oceanographer that I don't know. And I know that not that many physical oceanographers are on Twitter. So like it's a small percentage of oceanographers are there, and I'm seeing, you know, I don't know, a few tens of them at least. Even that's kind of surprising, and it gives me a little bit of a sense of just how big the field is, and it gives me hope that you know maybe I can maybe there are jobs out there.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, it's just a great way of meeting people, you know, virtually, so that, you know, if you bump into them at conference, you'll have instantly have some kind of connection that you can chat about.
Yeah. The Twitter thing. I met Rejected Banana.
Okay. I don't know Rejected Banana.
Kim Martini. So okay. She works at, she does a lot of the scientific instruments, like oceanographic instruments. Mm-hmm. And that was the first thing I said to her. I saw her name and I said, oh, you're Rejected Banana. Luckily, she knew what it meant. And she obviously, because that's her thing.
You know, certainly, when I was more early career scientist, you know, I spoke to people who I knew from Twitter that probably wouldn't have spoken to me without that connection.
Yeah.
More senior people. And so that was, you know, it's very good experience to have to get to know a wider group.
Yeah, what do you think about this? There's been this discussion about how personal versus professional scientists should be on Twitter. I think it's really interesting because I don't, obviously, you know, I mean, I kind of have an instinct for where I want to be, but I don't know. I don't think that's necessarily something that I could generalize. You know, I don't think I could tell a room full of people, oh, this is how you should be. It feels more like something that you have to kind of figure out for yourself. But there are folks out there who kind of take a hard line position and say, no, if you're a scientist, your social media platform should be 100% professional and you should never, you know, it almost feels like you, for those folks, you shouldn't even share an opinion of something. You know, you should almost only promote your papers and stuff. And for some folks, that might be the right way to do it. So I don't know. Where do you think personal versus professional, and where do you kind of
want? I certainly lean more towards the professional side.
Yeah.
I don't tend to discuss politics. You know, I see many other scientists doing that, and that's fine. You know, I don't have a problem with it, but I've taken the personal decision not to mix politics and science where possible. I'll very, very occasionally talk about personal aspects, but that's very rare. And most of what I talk about is science, the communication of science. But having those discussions with people, scientists and non-scientists, I think is an essential part of the platform, and you get more out of it by having those discussions, learning why people agree or disagree with you. That is a very valuable aspect of what goes on, and so I wouldn't, you know, I don't think just using it to promote your own papers and not commenting, I think is missing some of the benefits of the type of approach that to communication that it is.
Yeah, because one possible benefit is that now, you know, whether it's other scientists or just members of the like public, they can have more direct access to a scientist. We're not like hidden behind, we're not doing the whole ivory tower thing. We're trying to get away from the whole ivory tower thing, right?
And people can ask scientists questions that they've wondered about, and if, you know, if they're very genuinely interested and, you know, interesting questions, then, you know, I'm very happy to try and answer those where I can.
Yeah, and I mean, you've put a little bit of your personality in there. It's not like you're answering as a robot, you know, you're answering as a person and putting your...
And that is important. We are people, we have opinions and views and character and personality, and so it's important to appear like as a normal person, if you like.
A normal person. We have to do a good fake and appear like normal people. it's all good. I like this, I've been looking at the Climate Lab Book blog a bit, and so, you know, you've got some interesting kind of bits of advice on there and bits of code on there and, you know, things that people... Is that something... Can anybody contribute to that potentially, if you can submit something to that? How does that work?
They can, yeah. I started several years ago now to try and just be slightly more open about science in progress, to sort of put up interesting thoughts and ideas and plots and so on. I'm very happy to have contributions from any climate scientist who wants to discuss their latest research or latest idea, whatever it might be on. It's a platform for hopefully discussion of ideas and so on. So yeah, no, I'm very happy to have people involved. regularly or just a one-off. Yeah, either way.
So you're kind of an editor of that. You're kind of curating that a little bit.
That's right.
Cultivating
yes.
that. Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. I wanted to ask you. I like to ask all of my guests, partly because I'm still trying to learn myself, even though I've been doing it a while. I kind of am still kind of collecting information about how to do this, because it's a tricky thing, right? Writing papers, like, how do you approach writing? Is it something, do you enjoy it? Do you not enjoy it? You know, where do you kind of, what do you do?
I do enjoy writing.
Yeah.
I don't get as much time to do it as I would like now. But I think writing is an important part of doing the research itself. I think you will, as you're describing a particular figure that you've made, for example, you will prompt questions in your own mind about the interpretation when you're trying to describe it essentially to other people. And so writing about it, for me anyway, is part of the process, and it's an evolving process, because you will see things perhaps that you didn't perhaps see before or think about it slightly differently when you're writing about it. So that sort of prompts, you know, a further discussion or further research to sort of nail down a particular aspect. So I think it's very important for that.
It's iterative, right?
It is very much iterative. And I certainly encourage students and postdocs, whatever, to start writing early their results. And so they prompt those thoughts.
Yeah. Yeah. So you write something down, you make a plot, you know, and that kind of might bring up new ideas. It might force you to kind of revise your thinking about something. I guess the tricky thing then, you know, you start doing that, and potentially there's no end to that process, right? You know, you always think of new things, the things you should try. So how do you cultivate that sense of, like, okay, this is enough. I don't have to go back and iterate on this yet again. I need to just stop. You know, like, how do you get...
I find that quite hard, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, there's always more questions to answer.
Yeah.
And so, you know, once you have once you've answered a couple of questions, then you go, okay, I can finish there at that point, but leave the questions open for a further study later on down the line.
Yeah, it's just an instinct thing, isn't it? It's just something that takes time to develop.
I think it does, there's no right answer, no magic answer to that, I don't think.
Yeah, because we sort of have deadlines. I mean, we need to produce kind of a certain baseline number of papers per year, but it's not like, I don't know, I haven't experienced this myself, but, you know, you get a book deal or something and you've got like a deadline, your publisher gives you a deadline and you're like, I want a chapter by this day. But if you don't have that external kind of constraint, you've got to do it for yourself. You have to, I guess, decide, okay, yeah, I'm going to work to get this paper out by this date. So you have to be your own editor in that sense.
I mean, I think push yourself it is way. Slightly unfortunate that there is this pressure from number of papers. I don't particularly like that myself.
Yeah.
I think it is much better to do one very detailed, solid, in-depth analysis than two shallower analysis. I would much further work with someone who is going to write those in-depth papers than the shallower ones. You know, number of papers is one metric of our output as a scientist, but looking at those papers, I think, is more important about what's actually in them, if we want to sort of understand the person who's writing them,
right,
for example.
It's just such an easy thing to do, just count people's papers, that that's the sort of default kind of bean counter approach to evaluating somebody. Is like,
unfortunately, it is.
Yeah,
yes.
Like, number of papers.
Quality is more important than quantity, for, you know, a lot of the time.
Yeah, that's unfortunate, yeah. And it's... it would be fine if you imagine a scientist who only wrote like four papers ever, but what if they're four amazing papers? Then that should be fine too. That should be permitted, you know, as well. And it takes time for like big ideas to show up and to be cultivated and to trimmed. And so, yeah, it kind of raises questions about how people are evaluated. But I guess that's we talked about this with Dave Monday, actually. The tricky thing is, you know, whatever you do, whatever kind of quantitative system you try to come up with to measure scientists, then everybody shifts their behavior to like, well, now we're going to do that thing. So if you just start counting people's papers, they're going to write more papers, more smaller papers to kind of game that system. But there's a big demand from management to have like quantitative, you know, easy to read metrics of what's this index and that score and what's the, there's something that kind of, for some folks who work in Australia, I've seen it's kind of terrifying. They have your profile page is like, well, here are all of your indices. We're going to reduce you to nothing but that. And here's like your,
I think that's rather unfortunate. See the bigger picture about, you know, the rounded scientist that someone is, I think is far more important.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I remember seeing one of these pages, and it's just kind of, it's shocking. It's like, oh, that's all I am. I'm these numbers. like, you just put them on your shirt or something. Like,
you know, tattoo them on.
Tattoo them on. Here's my H index tattoo on my wrist. That's the only. How long have you been in Reading?
I've been in Reading for 12, 13 years now.
Yeah.
Yeah, so fair old time now.
Do you live nearby?
I live quite close. Just cycle to the university every day.
Okay, nice. Yeah, does it take long? That or 20
20 minutes,
or something? Yeah. Are the cars pretty good at looking out for cyclists here, or because in Cambridge they kind of do okay, but it's sort of terrifying at the same time.
the vast majority are great. There's one or two who I think would prefer that cyclists weren't on the road.
When you said one or two, it gave me a mental image of like there's two specific who like drive around Reading looking for like actively discouraging cyclists. Yeah, it seems like a nice. Do you like the size of the town and the university? It seems for me, I'm feeling pretty comfortable.
The university is fantastic. We've got a fantastic group of people here, researchers, but more broadly, the university is on a very nice, large, open, green campus. So I cycled past bluebells and daffodils and everything else this morning.
Across the bridge.
And this lovely lake and geese and everything. So it's a very nice atmosphere to walk around in. So it feels very open, which I like.
Yeah, that's good. I keep forgetting and then remembering what it's like to be on a self-contained university campus like this. Because, you know, Bass is out by itself. And then Cambridge, if you go to the university, it's kind of just... It's in the city, but it's not a distinct entity, right? You can't point to any location and say, well, that there is Cambridge University. It's just interspersed throughout the whole city and kind of integrated into it. It's definitely its own little world, you know, like
you
come in and has a distinct feel to it, and the average age of people is much lower. You
look around, it certainly is, yes.
I've crossed some kind of threshold in recent years where, you know, a few years ago, I could come to a campus like this, and in my head, still sort of go like, "Oh, I could be a student here. I could still fit in here." And now, I don't know if it's age or just kind of accumulated, just experience, but I no longer have that feeling. Mm-hmm. I'm walking around going like, "Oh, I'm not in this anymore. I'm not a student anymore. Something has happened to me over time." And now which is fine. It's okay. That's the whole evolution of the process. But it's just funny to notice things like that. And I guess thinking about your path, you know, now you do a lot of kind of helping other students, right, and supervising other students, and you know, you're kind of in this organizational role. That's one of the things that Mike and I talked about is he sometimes misses having that time to just work on his own problems and do his own writing and stuff. So how have you found that balance, you know, looking for that right balance between working on your own stuff and helping other folks and doing the kind of management role that you have to do?
So, you know, I've been very lucky in that I've had I had a fellowship from NERC for 5 years, which was fantastic, which meant that I could spend a large chunk of my time doing the research that I wanted to do myself. But at the same time, I've also been involved leading a couple of projects and being involved in several other very large projects, supervising students and postdocs. And that necessarily takes up time, which is great. You know, you're talking with, you know, bright young scientists, which has been a fantastic experience.
It's great, right? Yeah.
It is. It's brilliant to see, you know, them have excellent ideas to just go off and explore them and develop and mature as scientists. It's really, really fantastic to see.
That's one of the best things, when you work with a really bright student. I haven't had a PhD student, but I've had some awesome summer students and master's students. Mm-hmm. And you hand them a problem and you have a good science chat with them and wait a couple of days and results show up, like plots show up. And that's still an amazing thing to me. And like you said, it's really exciting to feel like, oh, I'm I'm helping this person like discover a new area of investigation for them and discover a new area of analysis. And it's really, really rewarding.
I mean, that's why we enjoy the science, right? It's to see those discoveries and new ideas. And it's an exciting part of what we do.
Yeah, but also, I mean, helping students who are passing through. You know, we're not just using them as results mills. You know, there's also a nice...
We're developing them as scientists.
Absolutely. Yeah. Or whatever they choose to go into.
Of course.
Because some folks, you know, well, lots of folks actually will go in a different direction. I've got an awesome master's student who has a job lined up at a big London financial house after this. He's doing awesome work in our field, and I kind of wish I could convince him to stay. But that's fine. He's got to go off and do his thing,
you
know, whatever makes sense for him. I really enjoyed that aspect of helping people and helping students. I kind of miss teaching for that reason, too. I used to teach like large classes, and you kind of had that daily contact with students. But once you do, since I'm in a research kind of institute now, there's not as much of that. Which is okay. It's just a different kind of mode to be in. Where were you before Reading?
So I had a slightly unusual career path in that I did my PhD in astrophysics
at
the University of Nottingham.
Oh, cool.
So a completely different topic, studying distant galaxies.
We should talk about that too.
Yeah, which is fascinating. Really enjoyed it, loved it, still enjoy learning about that science. But I felt that I wanted to do something a little bit more down to earth, a little more practical and useful.
You have to have that joke. You can't. Yeah. It's mandatory.
And so I actually went and worked outside academia for a year and didn't enjoy it. So I came back and ended up doing a master's course here in Reading to convert between being an astrophysicist and being a sort of meteorologist, climate scientist.
Okay.
And I was lucky enough to meet, the scientists that work here in Reading, and was lucky enough to get a postdoc straight out of that master's.
So sorry, you said the astrophysics thing was a PhD level?
PhD, yes.
Oh yeah, that's right. But in the UK, you do PhDs pretty early and pretty young, at least relative to like the US system, where it's 7 years and you've already done another degree. So there could still be time to switch paths and to do something different.
And there's a surprising number of climate scientists who've come from other fields. Especially astrophysics. For some reason, there seems to be a ready source of scientists coming in, which is fantastic. And I think they bring new ideas and new approaches.
We should talk about that, because that's where I started too.
Okay, fantastic.
Speaking of that, it was just for my undergrad and my master's, I was working with numerical modeling of dark matter halos of galaxy evolution.
Awesome.
It was a lot of fun. We at that time, modeling has like moved on since then, but at that time we could just do the dark matter, because that's most of the galaxy. We didn't even have gas, so we didn't have any matter that you could see in our simulations. It was just dark matter, and we would start it in these cosmological initial conditions, the expanding universe, and you make a little collection of particles that are dense enough to kind of collapse under their own gravity, and you look at the kind of shapes that they end up in. And I wasn't driving them, I was just an undergrad and master's student, but we ended up on a couple of neat papers looking at can you deduce the merging history of a galaxy from when you look at it now? Can you make any statements about, well, here's its past, here's the kind of, either it has merged smoothly with other galaxies, or it's had a
violent collision
past. That was pretty fun. And I enjoyed astrophysics, but I guess ultimately it just didn't quite feel like I could make a career in it. And I guess part of that was totally subjective. I just subjectively had this feeling of like, well, it felt a bit saturated to me. I didn't see the little niche that I could fit in. I didn't see like a way I could make a unique contribution. I felt like I would always just kind of be, a few steps behind. And it's not that I couldn't do the work. It just felt like very crowded. So, and I'm not looking for that sort of prompt. I'm not prompting you for anything in particular. I just telling you about my experience. And I want to, so what was your experience in astrophysics like? What was your...
I really enjoyed it. I was working on a very large team
we were building a new survey of distant galaxies, mapping them, called the 2DF Galaxy Redshift Survey, Cambridge were involved in. And
is that the Sloan? Is that
it? It was at the same time as Sloan.
Same time as Sloan. Okay.
But this is a UK Australia group doing something fairly similar.
Okay.
And so it was part of a big team and taking all these observations of these distant galaxies and mapping their locations better than we had before.
Yeah.
I really, really enjoyed that aspect.
That was your PhD.
That was my PhD. Yeah. And then, there are so many similarities, actually, between astrophysics and climate science. You know, they're both observational sciences in that, we can't directly do experiments.
Yeah.
To learn about what goes on. We just have to take the observations and learn from those observations.
Have to be happy with the photons we get.
Exactly. and if we miss observing a supernova or something, then we can't go back and reobserve it.
Yeah.
It's gone. And the same with climate. We can't go back in time and take all the observations that we would like to have taken back 2 centuries ago. We have to deal with the observations that we have. And so there's that aspect.
You can try to do paleo stuff. You can try to look at, paleo records. But it can be a bit hard, right? The error bars can be big just because you're trying to do a lot of complicated proxy measurements. Yeah. And it was sort of similar with that galaxy collision paper. It's not like you could make a really concrete statement about this has merged 3 times with 2 other galaxies. It was more of a very broad, violent or not violent kind of history. Mm-hmm. You can do pretty good with paleoclimate. That's not a negative statement about paleoclimate. Yep. I just mean it is hard and the error bars get bigger.
It's hard interpreting, precisely what the proxies mean is challenging, but it's, a very useful and important part of, the science that goes on.
Yeah.
But it also means, we have to rely on simulations as well. And as you say, the simulations have gradually improved over time in astrophysics and in climate science.
Yeah.
And because they've improved, they've become more useful and learn more details. We know they're not perfect, and we have to consistently remember that. But there's a lot of these similarities, which I think means that people can move through the fields, I think, very successfully, because it's a similar mindset of, it's an observational science. We have to rely on fluid dynamics and fluid dynamical simulations and so on. There's a lot of similarities there.
Yeah, that's a good point. Thinking about how both kind of climate and astrophysics, it's neither one of, you can't sit down in a lab and isolate your system.
Exactly. Yes.
You have to take the information that you can get from observations. You have to supplement it or deepen it in some way with your simulations and your theoretical understanding. I think it can be kind of nice, right? Because that sort of problem brings together the kind of observational and theoretical and modeling communities. There's a good overlap and a good kind of coherence there. We all need each other.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And the best climate science and the best astrophysics come from those collaborations and people joining together.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's part of why the community element is so important, like keeping relationships with scientists going. And I want to get back to your kind of history, because that's really interesting. So you came to Reading to do the master's, and then just continued, basically. You've been here. Did you?
I've stayed here ever since, actually, yes.
Yeah.
It wasn't the original plan, but no, it's worked out very well, and I enjoyed it.
That's great. That's really good, stability to be able to stay.
I mean, there is a slight sense from some scientists that, we have to move around to develop ourselves as scientists. There are some people who seem to who think that is a compulsory part of what we should be doing, and I do think that's very beneficial. If you go to a different institute, you're immersed in a different environment and you learn a lot, but I don't think it's essential. And I think if you want to stay in where you are and it's one of the best places in the world to do what you want with some of the best people, then you should stay and work in an area and a place where you're comfortable. You've got good relationships, and you know that you can do amazing science. So it's not one size fits all, And people sometimes seem to suggest that we should, you must do this, this, and this, and this, when actually I think we need to take a broader view. And if people are comfortable in a location, working with people, then we should try and ensure that is possible.
Yeah, I guess pretty often funding means that people end up having to hop around a lot, especially after your PhD. You know, folks end up often hopping around, you know, chasing one job after the other.
And that makes it very, very difficult, I think, especially if you're changing fields slightly, you have to learn. And, you know, learning is great, but sometimes, you know, you just want to immerse yourself in a particular problem, and that can take several years. And we don't necessarily have the processes to enable that all of the time, as much as we might like.
Yeah, I'll be honest. It's kind of like it's having, you know, the idea of having to move around a lot, chasing individual jobs. It's a lot of things. It's exciting in some ways because you get to go to new places and meet, you know, new people and get involved with different problems, but it's also terrifying because you don't feel like...
And some people love the hopping around, they really enjoy moving and exploring and meeting new people, and that's brilliant. But other people don't want to do that, and we need to try and make sure that the environment is there for both groups to thrive.
Yeah, I think I have really enjoyed it in the past, and now I'm getting a little tired.
You want to stay where you are.
Now I'm like, okay. And my, you know, my son's in school and stuff, and I'm kind of like, okay, I don't want to hop around anymore if I can help it.
It's a lot of effort to move.
It is, yeah. I'm not saying I wouldn't move if needed. I mean, that's obviously something that I'd consider if I needed to, but I don't know. It gets tiring after a while, and you get tired of kind of saying bye to places that you've gotten used to.
Groups
of friends.
Yeah,
so it can be a hard, kind of weird nomadic lifestyle. I've been fortunate enough to stay at the same place for a while, and so I'm hoping to minimize the number of additional moves that I have to make from here on out. So yeah, actually, when you said you've been here that long, part of me was like, that's awesome. Like, it's great that you've had that stability, that you've had that, like, you know, able to just kind of plop down, and not plop in a bad way, but, you know, put some roots down and stay in place for a while. That's awesome.
Yeah, be very lucky.
So where'd you grow up before your kind of PhD path with the whole astrophysics path?
So I grew up in the southwest of England.
Yeah.
And did a physics degree in Oxford, and then went on to Nottingham.
Cool.
After that, so moved around a bit around the country.
So the southwest, were you out on the peninsula there?
In Exeter.
In Exeter.
Where the Met Office is now.
So, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Cool. Yeah, I like Exeter a lot. We spent a week out there in October at the university, just visiting some people in the Met Office, and I liked how close the beach was. You know, you could get on a train and go to Exmouth, and the whole seaside town is right there. Did you go to the beach?
Yeah, no. I mean, Exeter's great, situated for the coast and for the hills of Dartmoor as well. It's a great location. Again, the university is a nice big green campus university as well. It's a really nice place to be.
Yeah, still family out there.
Got family there. Yeah.
Yeah. What are they up to? If you don't mind, like, what's the your folks? Or
They're retired now. So.
Retired, yeah. Just being. Retired out on the southwest.
Exactly, yes.
There's a pretty high percentage of retired folks on that, in the peninsula, if I remember right, you know, out there in the southwest.
Yeah, I think there are, yeah. It's a nice place to go and settle down, I think. Yeah.
Is it the Florida? Is it like the UK's Florida? Like,
somewhat, I guess, yes, a little bit.
When you're done, you either, like, go move to the southwest, or you can move to Spain or something, or, you know, go somewhere warmer. Go somewhere warmer as your skin gets thinner with age. I'm going to ask you a silly question occasionally ask people. So, you know, there's type 1 errors and type 2 errors, mm-hmm. right? Type 1 error is where you see a pattern that isn't there, and a type 2 pattern is where you miss patterns that are there. So if you had to make a choice, you've got to have one bias, one direction or the other in your life. Would you rather be biased towards making more type 1 errors or more type 2 errors? It's a silly question. Because you're thinking about, like, that... The difference between the two, and mm-hmm. like, which do you think you could cope with better?
I think missing things which are there is probably more comfortable.
You think
for
so?
Me,
yeah. Missing things which instead of
constantly seeing things which aren't there. That would worry me.
I guess we're not necessarily talking about seeing things that aren't mm-hmm. there, not like seeing visions or something, but I just mean maybe scientifically, you know, seeing a pattern that is there. Or seeing a pattern that isn't there, or I've gotten myself all tied up. Yeah. So do you feel that way scientifically too? Do you think, like, you'd, or would you rather?
I'd rather miss a right conclusion rather than make a false conclusion.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So you'd rather not have a false conclusion.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you would be biased in the.
If I had to make a choice.
If you had to make a choice, yeah, in this ridiculous hypothetical scenario, which doesn't happen at all. Yeah. So you would. I've managed to get my head turned around in this. Okay. So you would rather not make the mistake of. Finding patterns all over the place.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. Yeah, because I guess, you know, if you see a pattern that's not there and you publish it and you put it out there, then the whole scientific machinery, you know, the peer review machinery will hopefully tell you, okay, well, that's not there. That's not robust.
Yes.
And if that's all working like it should be, then that's really encouraging.
Yes.
I could see that, right? Because you don't want necessarily to have a reputation as, oh, everything that this person puts out, we keep discovering is not actually there. Yeah. So from that kind of consistency standpoint, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I mean, and you also, you know, I don't think you want, you know, our science is used to motivate policymakers to think about actions about whether they want to reduce our carbon dioxide emissions or not.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, when we are so policy relevant, I think we have to be especially careful about not drawing false conclusions.
Yeah.
And particularly robust. I guess that's, you know, other fields which aren't so policy relevant, you know, then which is more exploratory, then, you know, maybe that there's something different to be said. But I think when we're so policy relevant, I think it's very important to maintain that robustness.
It's interesting that you answered for all of science, though, it felt like, as opposed to like you personally.
Okay, it's very much a personal view.
No, I didn't mean that you were imposing that view on everybody, but I could tell that your perspective seemed to be one of considering the whole scientific field as producing. So I thought that's interesting, okay. Right? Because I think that points to you do feel a certain level of responsibility for the whole scientific enterprise, you know, as an entity, you're concerned about that, and you want that whole enterprise to produce, you know, good, robust science. That's a good answer. I think other things that I've kind of, well, we talked about writing a little bit, but what about writing proposals? That's a super different activity, right? How do you handle writing proposals? That's just a totally different monster.
It is. And the success rate for proposals are very low, and so it encourages you to only think about ideas which you think are fundable, which it may or may not be the same research that you would like to do yourself.
Yeah.
And that's you know, a slight tension which we don't always enjoy, I think. But yeah, having to write very differently in a way that will motivate the research for a broader group. That's obviously something which we need to think about more generally anyway, so I don't have a problem with that. But you know, there's a large push for our research to be seen to having impact and wider applicability, which is great. But we you know, we should ensure that, you know, we are providing solutions to issues that our science raises, but we must not also miss the fact that a lot of our research has come from just the sort of blue skies, more open thinking type research as well. And if we lose that, I think that's a big risk, that we must always have a certain amount of science going on which is more open-ended, as well as the specific projects which, you know, are looking for, you know, looking at very specific problems with to generate solutions.
Yeah, and I guess it's the folks who kind of lay out the funding and lay out they have a big role in setting, you know, what scientists end up actually doing. So it's fair to say that some of that responsibility is on them to kind of make a framework within which the kind of science that people want, that would be good for, you know, beneficial for humans, mm-hmm. for society,
yeah.
to for that to happen. And like you said, it's got to be a nice mix of very targeted things and very blue skies, kind of open-ended sort of science. Yeah, and I don't know what the right balance is. I wonder, it almost feels like that recently, and I'm making two. This is an overgeneralization. Mm-hmm. I'll frame it that way and totally admit that. I guess I worry that things are tilting in the direction of a very specific. You know, oh, well, we want you to produce a tangible benefit for the UK economy or the world economy or whatever country it is. You know, right now, we want you to have like an, and that is at odds with the kind of open-ended blue sky science that we were talking about, where you don't know where that science is going to go. You don't even know if the blue sky science is going to work. Is that just my own? I don't know if that's just my own personal perception bias or something, or if that has been, I don't know, in both the US and the UK.
Yeah, there's certainly been a shift towards more targeted specific projects to generate, you know, specific benefits. Many of those projects have been highly successful, and that's great. But I mean, I guess in the UK we have the national research centres such as BASS and the Oceanography Centre and NCAS, the Atmospheric Science Centre, which I'm part of, which do have a longer term remit to think about, that we can do longer term research programs to try and to think about the more blue skies aspect. And so we're very lucky to have those centres which can take that viewpoint.
Getting that mix is tricky.
But getting the mix is very tricky, I agree. If you're not part of one of those centres and you want to do some blue skies research, it's very difficult. And I think we need to encourage more of that where we can.
Yeah, try to turn some knobs on that and get the mixture right.
Yeah.
I guess what you need for that, hopefully there's a back and forth dialogue, you know, between the scientists and the funding agencies to like get the balance that everybody's happy with.
Yeah.
That's iterative too.
It is, and you know, ultimately our science is funded by, you know, general taxation, and so we must be providing benefit for all of that investment as well. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, you know, that makes me think, speaking of like the benefit to everyone, that makes me think about open access publishing and open access data. And there's, in my view, a pretty good argument you could make that, well, because we're publicly funded for the most part, that we should be making all of our papers open access, we should be making kind of all of our data set open access, and maybe we should even make it easier somehow for other folks to kind of participate in science and climate science. I don't know, what do you think? Do you have some thoughts on?
Yeah, kind of I'm very much of the view that you know, all of our data should be as open as possible, and I think there have been great steps in that direction over the last few years. Which is fantastic to see. You know, anyone can download, you know, a large number of the data sets that we use on a day-to-day basis. So, you know, that aspect is fantastic to see.
And I guess the other side of that, Pete Davis and I were talking about this last week, that researchers at the same time, the other side of that is, you know, researchers are often judged by their paper output and their data output and things. And so there has to be some kind of system by which, you know, researchers can still get appropriate credit for, oh, well, you made this data set, or you pulled this bit of insight out of this particular data set. So there's sometimes some protectiveness, right? Researchers want to save their data set to give them kind of a first crack at it so they can produce some initial papers. And I understand where that's coming from too. I mean, that's fair enough. And I don't know what the right balance is between those things. But, you know, right now the system we have is that researchers are, that's one of the metrics, is publications, and so people are naturally protective of their ability to get new things out of the data and to publish.
So yeah, we've certainly seen a drive towards publishing data sets now, which is great, and they can be cited in the literature and so on, and that gives a certain amount of credit to the person who created it. But they undoubtedly should be, you know, an embargo period for someone who has done the experiments or collected the observations to do the research they want to do before making it available. I think, you know, we need to ensure that embargo is relatively short, but the researchers who've done that should, as you say, get first crack at doing the science they want to do. And I think the balance is reasonable at the moment. There is an increasing drive towards open access, especially with some of the, you know, the old records we've got and so on, and I think that's great.
Yeah, absolutely. What do you? We were talking about grants a second ago, and that the kind of low success rate. And this is something that, you know, I'm putting together a proposal now, so I'm mentally trying to get myself in the right framework for, you know, spending a ton of time working on something,
yep,
fully anticipating it to not go anywhere. So how do you handle the kind of, it's not a failure, but it can feel like one, you know, you put all this work into something and it just doesn't get funded for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. Maybe there are tons of other, you know, there's highly competitive, these funding pots, right? There can be tons of good proposals going in, and sometimes yours just isn't one of those.
Yeah.
And there can be a huge variety of reasons that don't even necessarily reflect on your proposal. It could just be the environment, the funding environment that your proposal went into. So how do you strike that right balance for yourself, you know, that mental preparation for this probably is going to not go anywhere?
That's hard, and it's hard when it's turned down, and you've invested all this time and mental effort. But I think, you know, the way to think about it is an investment of time, in that, you know, while writing that proposal, you will have crystallized your own thoughts about a particular topic and identified certain directions that you think, you know, need to be gone into to make progress in that particular problem. And so, you know, that is not wasted. I mean, some of the time will have been wasted, but, you know, having that investment in crystallizing where you think things should be going is very, very valuable to have done.
Because at the end of that, you will have a very clear idea of what you want to do.
Yes.
You've spelled it out.
Yes.
And I guess I can kind of accept that, right? I guess it could be harder if you kind of feel like your job prospects and everything hinge on whether or not this thing gets accepted or not, which is this grant application, you know, gets accepted or not, which is that's a hard mental balance to strike, because you have to prepare yourself for the possibility that it's not going to go through, even though kind of knowing that this particular grant application could be kind of make or break for you. It could send you in very different directions in your whole life. So you almost have to decouple from it in a way. You have to maybe...
That's
like,
hard. That's really hard. Because you know there's an element of luck, you know, in the process about who's on the panel, who's reviewed your proposal on that particular day. There is an element of chance, which is slightly unsatisfactory, but we can't really get around it, I don't think.
No, and I guess, you know, everybody will have kind of different ways to deal with that, but I guess you almost have to, detach yourself a little bit from it and try to not be so personally invested in it, even though it is extremely personal, even though it does determine a lot about your potential, you know, future. So it's like a high wire act for your...
And if you continue to think it's really important, then then you need to keep pushing,
keep going.
You know, eventually it will be successful.
Yeah, keep putting it out there, and it can come to life in some form through some avenue.
Yes. Yeah. So I've certainly had that with one of my projects recently. I've for a long time tried to advocate that we need to better understand past changes in weather and climate, and one way of doing that is to ensure that all of the weather records that were taken 100 years ago, we now have modern digital access to.
Yeah.
It may be surprising to know that, you know, there are millions of pages of weather observations just from the UK, which are sitting in the archives, which have never been scanned or digitized and turned into usable data. Yeah.
This is the Weather Rescue Citizen Science kind of project.
It is, yes.
So it took a while to get.
So I've certainly been trying to get funding for this type of activity for, you know, a few years.
Okay. Yeah.
Without much success, but, you know, as a, you know, a chance conversation meant we got, you know, a small seed funding through a public engagement grant to kickstart the project. And it's been amazingly successful. And so continuing to talk about what you would like to do, you know, hopefully eventually you will manage to get what you want out of it.
Yeah. But, you have to find something, an idea, something that you want to exist, you know, something that I want this to happen, you know, a science activity or an outreach activity of some kind.
Yes.
And just grab onto it and try to manually push it through, and somehow, you know, it can feel a bit like pushing a boulder up a hill and then watching it roll back down again, the whole Sisyphean kind of thing. But But yeah, just, I don't know, keep at it.
Don't eventually you might get the bolt to the top of the hill and, you know, it'll go down the other side instead. The other side. But no, you know...
Maybe that's not the best metaphor for this. But yeah, no, I
know. And then, you know, the particular aspect about the weather rescue project I'm particularly happy about is involving volunteers in the activity, you know, teaching people about weather and climate science and the science, the process of doing science, I think is very important to, you know, get people to question what they're looking at when they see, you know, whatever it is, in this particular case, some old weather measurements, or there's other amazing citizen science projects around looking at pictures of historical storms, and or, you know, there's any number of projects, any number of different fields, you know, seeing animals and so on, categorising them. It gets people thinking about you know, what they're seeing and processing and uncertainty and all of these important aspects that, that we have, that we think about on a daily basis, but it's important to get other people thinking about these types of issues, I think, behind the scenes.
Is there like an opportunity for some of the problems you just kind of mentioned made me think, in addition to having people do it, any opportunities for kind of machine learning type approaches for, you know, analyzing this all?
There's certainly, I think there are certain tasks which I think, you know, human eyes and the human brain are still uniquely suited to solving. You know, reading handwriting, you know, in tabular form, for example, I think is one at the moment where it's very hard to machine to do that. Not impossible, I think, but it's pretty challenging. Spotting patterns in data is often easier for humans, it seems, than machines. You know, I think the technology of handwriting recognition and machine learning and all these other things which are coming online, you know, are going a long way to narrowing those gaps, and I think there'll be more progress in the near future. And so I think, you know, there may be times where machine learning can sort of do a lot of this. I don't know how far they'll go and whether it'll completely take over from all the tasks that humans can do at the moment about these types of activity. Yeah. But you know,
we'll
see.
Because we need jobs and stuff.
True.
We need something to do. Otherwise, we'll just sit around and make art for each other. And that's all we'll be able to. We'll make art for each other, and we won't use the rainbow color bar when we make that art for each other.
Like, very important.
You know, I have gotten away from that. I've gotten away from the rainbow color bar.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that you, I appreciate that you have such a push for, like, you know, trying to push for color vision friendly kind of, you know, color maps and color bars. Because I'm a bit colorblind myself, actually.
Okay. Yep.
And so it's a fairly common occurrence for me to look at a plot at a conference and to just not be able to. I have okay color vision. It's not like terrible, but blues and purples are really similar to my eye for some reason. Often there's a plot with, you know, 400 different colors or something, and my eyes just can't quite, like, well, I don't know. I just need some, at that point, I need somebody to point at the thing and tell me what I'm supposed to get from it.
A group of us have certainly been pushing the idea that we need to think slightly harder when we're making graphics about the design of the graphics. The colour scale is one aspect, but there's many other aspects to think about as well, and to try and ensure that they're, you know, giving the represent the data efficiently, effectively, and, you know, without any distortion. And so making conscious decisions about how to represent the data is very important to not necessarily just accept the defaults that your plotting software happens to give you.
Yeah.
For example, color is an important part of that, and the rainbow color car is, you know, one example where it's very prevalent because it's the automatic setting for many pieces of software. You know, and the rainbow color car, as you said, is particularly bad for those who are colorblind. But it also, perhaps more importantly, can introduce false perceptual boundaries into your data when no boundary actually exists, around yellow. And the transition between yellow and green can be very, very sharp and appear like there's a sharp boundary when in fact there isn't any.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's been a lot of work in the sort of the colour science community to create color scales which are better suited for representing continuous data, for example, to ensure that we see the features that are there and not features that aren't. And so getting people to think about these topics and use color scales and other plotting tools which allow them to represent the data efficiently and effectively, and it's really important that we do that on a day-to-day basis.
There's this Viridis one that I almost liked. I almost like. I don't quite like it. So I guess I've seen it and I've played around with it a little bit, and something just wasn't quite clicking for me with it for some reason. But then a couple of weeks ago, a friend of mine, I've got a friend who he's in solar physics, and him and I often exchange nerdy messages about color scales and color bars and plots and things like that. And so he showed me this Civitas one. I don't know if you seen that one.
I haven't seen that one.
So it's Civitas. It's more like it's more like a single kind of color gradient.
Okay.
You know, where Viridis has a few of them in there.
Mm-hmm.
And Civitas is supposed to be a bit better for color deficient vision. And something about it, maybe that, jumped out at me. Okay. And I went, okay, that works for me. That's awesome.
Great.
So, So I think there's still an element of choice. It's not like you have to go, one particular direction that everybody else is going, but maybe just like I think you're encouraging people to be critical about their choice of color bars and not just accept the kind of default one. I guess the default ones are getting a bit better in some.
They are improving, definitely.
Push, right?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. And I mean, the push has been going for a while, but the defaults are certainly changing, which is great. And I think, what you say about the color scales that you prefer is that there's not necessarily right answers about what scales to use, but there's probably wrong answers.
Right.
And trying to reduce the number of wrong answers in favor of more right answers, I think, is the way to go.
Yeah. good. I was just looking at my list here. I think we talked about a lot. Yeah, we talked about a lot of things. I think we pretty much kind of covered the stuff on my list here, except I don't know, you probably talked about it a bunch, the whole spiral thing.
Yeah.
You probably have said a ton about this already, but I thought, you weren't informed of that beforehand, right? The whole spiral thing being used in the Olympic, somebody just downloaded that and made a montage for the Olympics, and then it was. So is that how you, were you watching at the time?
I was watching, yes.
And then there was, that must have been weird.
So I'd made this graphic back in May before the Olympics, and it had gone a bit viral on Twitter, which was great. And then, I was, I'd actually, it was a Friday night. I'd been very exciting. I'd gone to IKEA and bought some flat pack furniture, and was sitting at home putting together the flat pack furniture while watching the Olympic opening ceremony.
Olympics are kind of on in the background.
Yeah,
you're trying to put
some shelves together.
I was trying to think of a name of an IKEA thing, the tables and stuff, the Horfler or something, like that. But so you're putting.
Yeah, I was there putting the shelves together, and then there was the bit was on the ceremony about climate change, so I sort of paid more closer attention.
Yeah.
And then suddenly this graphic appeared on the screen representing the rise in temperatures, and that's essentially, they had redrawn it themselves. There wasn't actually the same graphic that I produced, but they'd redrawn it in the same style and the same way,
this polar coordinate thing where it spirals out
exactly and that was quite a shock, because I hadn't been told about it beforehand. The graphics that I produced are all open access, and anyone can download them, and that's great. But no, so they hadn't.
Yeah, it's kind of a neat, when you say it's open access, that's kind of a neat success story, I guess, if you want to say it that way. If you make stuff open access, as long as you can, as long as that's fine for you career-wise and stuff, then it might get used in nice ways. It might get used in ways that you don't expect. That's a positive example. I imagine there might be negative examples too, potentially. I don't know if
There was one negative example when it was quite early on after I'd started the blog, and I put on a graphic I'd been working on, just an idea essentially, very informal, about comparing our observations of global temperature with some simulations of what been going on. And the graphic was talking about a particular aspect of how you do that comparison can make quite a big difference to your interpretation, and I put that on the blog, and then they got used by a national newspaper a few days later to try and cast doubt on the fact that what we were seeing in the observations was not comparable with what our simulations were telling us.
Right.
And this caused quite a stir in the media and so on. So that was an example where they had taken something from the blog without permission, without asking, and used it and misinterpreted what was represented.
That's the thing, because it's not like you weren't making a first order, you know, statement about everything's completely wrong and we have to change, you know, this is a paradigm shift in the way that we think about climate. It was more like, oh, let's make it, there's a tiny adjustment we need to make right here.
There's a subtle issue about how you do that comparison, which you need to ensure that you're comparing apples with apples rather than apples and aardvarks. You know, and that was the point I was trying to make, but that could easily, as it turned out, be misrepresented and misused.
There was this great Economist article a few years ago where the author kind of pointed out, he said, well, whenever you read an article about climate science, ask yourself, do they want me to think about climate science as a jigsaw puzzle that is mostly complete, but there are some missing bits here and there? Or do they want me to think about climate science as a house of cards? And that's been such a useful conceptual tool for me to, like, you know, read a news article and ask that question. You know, are they trying to make the statement that, aha, we've pulled out this one card from the bottom and now the whole house of cards has collapsed? Isn't that a relief? We don't have to worry about climate anymore. Versus the picture that I'm pretty confident in saying that the vast majority of scientists and climate scientists think of climate as the jigsaw puzzle picture. Yeah. We've got a good first order understanding. We know, you know, what the overall jigsaw puzzle looks like. No, we don't have all the pieces in place, and there are some bits that maybe haven't been put in exactly the right place, and we'll figure that out. But those are not first order questions, you know? Like, we know the basic physics, and that's not going to change. You put carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, you get more energy down here at the surface, and it's going to go somewhere.
Yeah, it's basic physics, yes.
It's really simple physics. You can't get rid of it. That energy is going to go somewhere. And it looks like a lot of it's going into the oceans. So I think in that case that you just mentioned the negative case, and you see it in lots of articles, that author that misinterpreted your data, your blog post, was trying to sell the idea that, oh, well, climate science is a house of cards, and here I've found just the single card I can pull out to collapse.
Yeah. Very much so, yes. I've also heard a similar analogy about the jigsaw puzzle as to seeing, you know, the state of our science as a picture. You know, initially we started off with perhaps, you know, a sketch drawing. And we've slowly graduated into sort of maybe a painting and maybe a Polaroid photograph. And slowly, you know, we're getting more and more crispness and, you know, more towards a digital many megapixel type image of what we're trying to see. I think the process, the way I see it, is that, you know, we started with a sketch of our understanding of how the physics of the atmosphere worked, you know, back in the 1800s. And through time, we've been gradually refining that, adding more detail, and slowly that picture is getting crisper and crisper and crisper.
And we're
very confident about what's in the picture.
Yeah,
you know, we can see that. We've seen that for a long time. We're just improving the representation or understanding of what we're seeing.
Yeah, in the U.S. anyway, you can use this great phrase like, "Look, it's Civil War era science." It's from the.
I guess it is. Yes, absolutely.
What was happening here around the 1860s, 1800s? So you can use the same. Is that Victorian or is it Victorian?
Yeah, Victorian, yeah.
So, this is Victorian era science.
And it very much is, yeah. I mean, that's when John Tyndall did his experiments in London to demonstrate what became known as the greenhouse effect. That was 1860s.
Yeah. And we've known that basic picture since then, and that hasn't changed, and it's not going to change.
No, it's fundamental physics and chemistry.
Yeah. We're not suddenly going to discover, like, oh, actually, all the energy is just going to vaporize and, you know, get transported off and the form of cosmic rays or some bizarre thing like that.
I think it's an important aspect of how we communicate our science, actually, which isn't necessarily used as much as it might be, is that the fact that we have understood this for the basics of this for 150 years.
Yeah.
We have, you know, the first evidence that global temperatures were increasing, that was 80 years ago in 1938. And even then it was suggested that some of that increase was due to carbon dioxide.
Yeah.
And so, you know, gradually we've been refining that picture, but, you know, it's not some modern environmental crusade.
No,
it is very much about fundamental physics and chemistry, which we've been you know, working on for 150 years, if not 200 years.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And it's there's a scientist out at Colorado State, Scott Denning, who he likes to say that climate change is simple, serious, and solvable. And the simple part is, it's Civil War era science, and when you add heat to something, it warms up. It changes state in some way. He likes to use the analogy of, you know, put a kettle on, right? You put a kettle on the stove in the U.S., or here you've got press an electric button. Kettle, yeah. And you just press the button, and then you add energy to the kettle, and something happens to it, and it boils, and the temperature raises, and the phase changes, and it goes somewhere. So you're right that you don't see that as much. I'm not totally sure why, but there is like a really basic old, super well-established core of physics here, mm-hmm. of science. And I guess a lot of scientists, we get so interested in those small uncertainties, in fitting our piece of the jigsaw puzzle into, yes. the larger picture, yes. that ends up being something that we talk about, which is a good thing to do, and it's an honest thing to do as well, because you don't want to pretend like you have 100% complete understanding of the whole picture. But it's almost like that gets amplified sometimes, like when a climate scientist or a scientist in general is talking about the relatively small uncertainty associated with their project or idea that they're interested in, that can get picked up on potentially by folks who want to frame climate science as the more house of cards kind of style thing. So yeah, keeping that house of cards versus jigsaw puzzle, mm-hmm. contrast is really useful in my mind. I think we pretty much got through everything.
Great.
Is there anything else you want to talk about?
Not that I think of, no. I'm feeling good, yeah. I mean, if you know, if people want to get involved with Weather Rescue and help us rescue millions more observations that were taken over a century ago and fill in some of those gaps that we have in our understanding of past weather, then weatherrescue.org is the place to go.
Nice. Okay. Well, thanks, Ed.
Thanks, Dan.
Yeah, I really appreciate it.
No problem.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, no.
Great.
Thanks for doing that.
No worries.
I thought that went really well.
I thought it was really interesting. Good chats. Wide-ranging topics.
Yeah. There you have it. Ed Hawkins, Professor of Climate Science at the University of Reading. Thanks a lot to Ed for joining me for this chat. I really appreciate your time. I appreciate it with everyone. Everyone that I talk to, they're really busy people. They're really active people. And their time means a lot to me. And so thanks to all my guests for taking time aside to sit and talk with me. We mentioned this End the Rainbow thing. So if you look up Ed Hawkins, The End of the Rainbow, you'll find entries from the Climate Lab book and also from other websites. There's an End Rainbow hashtag on Twitter. What that's about, so Ed Hawkins wants to get rid of the rainbow color bar because it's perceptually really bad news. The yellow color stands out. Your eye picks it out preferentially over the other colors. So check that out online. I've been trying to get away from the rainbow color bar. You know, it's a good thing to do if you plot quantities. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for downloading, listening. See you in a couple weeks. Not literally. Bye.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.